You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Will Tanner from Charlottesville, here on behalf of the appellant Waynesboro Village, LLC. At issue here is the trial court's granting of a motion for summary judgment relating to the expiration of a restrictive covenant that applies to a parcel that was purchased by a company, by the appellee, Chick-fil-A, Inc. While I'm aware that the court is familiar with the facts of the case, I think there are certain facts that we ought to go back and revisit just briefly so the context of my argument makes a little more sense. The property at issue in this case is on the south side of Interstate 64 at exit 94 in the city of Waynesboro. Back prior to 1989, there was a factory outlet shopping center there that was owned by a company called Shenandoah Village Associates. It was on a 140-acre parcel. At some point prior to 1989, Shenandoah Village Associates entered into negotiations with a company called BMC Properties to cut off a 4-acre parcel from that original 140-acre parcel that BMC then purchased. That purchase and the deed that reflects that purchase contains the restrictive covenants the restrictive covenant that is at issue here. There are, in fact, two restrictive covenants that were negotiated and agreed to at that point. The covenant that we have at issue here contemplated a change in use from the factory outlet that existed on the ground at the time to a discount retail center. This was again negotiated between real estate developers and a company that developed properties for hotel uses, which is BMC. Now, in 1994, Waynesboro Village purchased the larger property and litigation ensued with BMC relating to the restrictive covenants at issue here. The restrictive covenants at issue here prohibited Waynesboro Village from developing a hotel or lodging on its property and prohibited BMC from developing any sort of fast food or discount retail on its property on the smaller 4-acre parcel. In its opinion in 1998, this court found that two things that are of very great significance for the purpose of this appeal. First, is that the covenants themselves are unambiguous in their terms. They are unambiguous and clearly enforceable. In that case, Waynesboro Village actually lost, unfortunately, which leads us to why we're here today. But lost under very understandable circumstances. The covenants themselves were unambiguous and they were enforceable. And BMC, while it had not developed the property for hotel use, could have developed the property for hotel use and intended to develop the property for hotel use, and therefore the restrictions were enforceable. The second thing that the court found...
But that first case didn't focus on the definition of discontinue.
That is correct.
I don't want to be overly simplistic about this, but you tell me if I'm wrong. Your case today depends on the following. This restriction shall only apply for so long as any portion of the remaining property owned by the party of the first part is being used as a factory outlet and or discount retail stores. Upon the discontinuance of such use, this restriction shall expire. So I read this case, and you tell me if this is too simplistic. This entire case depends on the definition of discontinuance.
I think this entire case depends on the definition of discontinuance that is raised in the context of the not only the origination of these restrictive covenants, but the overall plan of development that this court found in the 1998 earlier Waynesboro Village case. This court found very explicitly that these properties were subject to a general plan of development whereby fast food and discount retail would be developed on Waynesboro Village's property, which is what essentially happened. And then on the 4-acre parcel would be hotel and lodging and the uses there. That general plan of development informs the meaning of the word discontinuance, as does the fact that the restrictive covenant itself utilizes the phrase, I'm glad you brought this up, Justice Lemons, utilizes the phrase and/or, because what that tells us is that the factory outlet that's on the ground, the parties to the restrictive covenant understood and recognized that the use of the property could change over time.
Well, there was a cessation of use as a factory outlet to prepare for use as a discount retail store.
That is correct. That is correct.
And the amount of time was 14 months, is that right?
It was 14 months, and I'll go ahead and jump to that. What the trial court seemed to focus on was the fact that during the course, basically from June 23rd of 2000, excuse me, I think the actual cutoff date is going to be June 30th under the record that we have here, June 30th of 2006 until I believe it's August 27th of 2007, the activity that was going on the property was the demolition of the old factory outlet center, and the development and redevelopment of the property for the specific purpose of discount retail. Now, our position throughout this entire litigation has been that does not operate as a discontinuance because the entire use leading up to the closing where Waynesboro TC purchased this particular property, purchased the 53-acre parcel, where Waynesboro, leading up to that, there was engineering going on, there was cooperation amongst the parties in informing the tenants that their leases were going to, the existing tenants, that their leases were going to expire as of June 30th, and that this new, what was described by the member manager of Waynesboro Village LLC as a power shopping center, was going to be developed on the property over the course of the next year.
Mr. Tanner, it seems to me that your position is that you wouldn't be here but for the and/or language in that restriction.
Precisely.
And that it says, discontinuance of such use refers to factory outlet and/or discount retail stores. And the 14, if you had it only said factory outlet and you destroyed it, it would be a discontinuance.
That is precisely
so your correct. Argument is that such use applies to both, and a 14-month interval between destroying the outlet and constructing the retail stores was actually contemplated by the restriction.
That's exactly our argument. You have summarized it probably better than I was going to summarize it here
today.
I probably
ought to be asking that question to him, shouldn't I?
Well, what you're pointing out, though, what you're pointing out, I think, is extremely important in the context of the way restrictive covenants works, restrictive covenants of this type work, particularly where we have a prior case that tells us what the general plan of development is. This is a method by which developers divide up the bundle of sticks that go along with a particular piece of property. And when they do that, they choose very specific words to do it. And what Your Honor is pointing out is that there were specific words that were utilized in this particular case, and the factory outlet was on the ground operating when those words were generated. And that's extremely important in this case. In 1989, that factory outlet center was already operating. And if the parties to that covenant didn't anticipate the change from factory outlet to discount retail stores, they wouldn't have included the and/or discount retail stores in the restriction. And I think that is the point that the trial court ultimately ended up missing. Perhaps it was because I didn't point it out clearly enough to the trial court, but I think that's the point that the trial court ended up missing about this restrictive covenant. And in doing so, the trial court then defeated the general plan of development that this court found back in 1998 in the earlier Waynesboro Village case. And that's what we're here to try and reverse. What we'd like the court to do is reverse and remand this case for trial. There are some other issues of fact that aren't related to this particular issue about a discontinuance. But ultimately, what we're asking the court to do here is define what a discontinuance is in this context. Because the trial court itself confessed considerable difficulty in determining at what point a discontinuance would occur. And that's where the basketball analogy came into the letter opinion about halftime constituting a discontinuance of the game. Now, counsel, I'm from Kentucky, and Mr. Barkley here, I believe, is from North Carolina, and I think you'd have a hard time convincing, certainly me, that halftime in a Kentucky basketball game is a discontinuance of that game. It simply isn't. The game isn't over until it's over. And the basketball gym is not a basketball gym at night because the lights are turned off. And part of the problem with the way the trial court ended up ruling in this case, after confessing this difficulty in determining what is a discontinuance for the purposes of this restrictive covenant, part of the problem with that is that there's no real limiting principle on it. When is it? Is my house not being used for residential purposes because I go on vacation for a week?
Well, counsel, in that regard, what, if any, significance is it that the property was used as a fire training?
Well, Judge Franklin noted that during the course of his, when we were arguing the case, Judge Franklin noted that, and the precise citation of that is in my reply brief. There's a reason why the Waynesboro Fire Department came over and did training exercises, and that's because it's a very inexpensive way to demolish buildings. You let the fire department burn the buildings down and conduct training exercises, and that's precisely what happened. And Judge Franklin and everybody knows why that was. It was not as if Waynesboro TC leased the property to the fire department, who then built a structure to conduct exercises, did that, and then left. That's not what happened. What the fire department did was it assisted in the demolition, the necessary demolition of the old factory outlet center, by burning the buildings down and conducting its training exercises. Now, unless there are other questions, I'd like to reserve whatever time I've got for rebuttal.
4 minutes and 10 seconds.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm James Barkley, and like Mr. Tanner, I'm also from Charlottesville, and like Mr. Tanner, I'm also a college basketball fan. And while we may have enjoyed Judge Franklin's use of the basketball analogy, I don't think it's ultimately controlling for this court's decision.
Well, besides, a lot of Kentucky and North Carolina games are over by halftime.
Well, they are, and we're hopeful. I'm not sure if they meet in December this year as they typically do. The other thing I would note is it's a privilege to be here this morning in light of the court's recognition of the new members of the bar. It's a privilege to be with Mr. Tanner and try to fulfill the spirit and obligation we have from a professionalism standpoint. And while there's a lot at stake, it is heartwarming and reaffirming for me, and I just want to take a minute to acknowledge that it's a positive experience to be able to litigate with somebody like Mr. Tanner. So let's talk about a couple of things here, if we might. First off, this case is not about whether the trial court preempted the fact-finding by the trier of fact, although there's much made of that in the briefing by the appellant. That's not the argument here today. What this case is about, as Mr. Tanner says, is whether the trial court correctly interpreted the expiration clause of the restrictive covenant in light of the undisputed facts. And it was interesting to me as we listened to the first case today, that case and this case I think are going to be decided by this court largely by the words used in the standards that govern the interpretation in the first case of statutes, in this case of restrictive covenants. And those standards are not foreign to any of us, and we know them well, and they're not in dispute. As it relates to this case, restrictive covenants, for a very clear reason, are to be strictly construed, and the language taken most strongly against the grantor and most favorably to the grantee. And that's unique language in the history and the jurisprudence of this court. Most strictly construed, most strongly against the grantor, and most favorably to the grantee. I would add as a footnote that, for reasons that will become clear in a minute, and if there's any ambiguity in the context of a restrictive covenant, that ambiguity has to be construed against the grantor in favor of the free use of the property. Well, what does that mean in this particular case for Chick-fil-A? What that means is, as applied to the expiration clause, which is what we're talking about this morning, the expiration clause has to be construed most strongly in favor of its having been triggered. That is, most strongly in favor of its expiration. What Mr. Tanner said this morning is that the expiration clause and the use of the words and or together as a modified contraction of some sort, modified conjunction, shows that the original grantor contemplated a change of use over time. Well, I Mr. Tanner and I know each other quite well, and I would, as respectfully as I can, I would say that we take a diametrically opposed view. You will not find anywhere in the restrictive covenant or in the expiration clause the concept of change of use. What you will find over and over, as I'll explain in just a minute, is a repetitive, clear indication by the original grantor that the restrictive covenant that was imposed on the four-acre parcel, which is what we're talking about, had a very narrow, limited scope, and that it was to expire upon the discontinuance, that is, the cessation or interruption of the use of the larger parcel immediately. It did not contemplate a change of use. And one of the things that I had not planned on doing, but since it's come up, this court has criticized harshly in the past the use of the phrase and/or. And I would just cite to the court the Moltz versus Moltz case, which is found at 182 Virginia 737. And I'm sorry I didn't bring a copy for Mr. Tanner, but here's what this court said in 1944. It referenced the chancellor's finding in a domestic relations case, and the chancellor said, it further appearing to the court that the charge of willful desertion and or cruelty as alleged in the answer and cross-bill of the defendant, Madeline Laura Moltz, has been fully sustained. The Supreme Court, your prior justices, said this, we cannot tell from the use of and or whether the trial court thought that cruelty had been shown, that desertion had been shown, or that both had been shown. Its use is criticized in Corpus Juris Segundum, and in the Bell versus Wayne United Gas case, it was said to be disingenuous, modernistic, hybrid, inept, and irritating, and with this, we have no quarrel.
Well, that was our court talking to a trial judge.
Well, how much more should this court use perhaps more temperate language, more diplomatic language, when talking to the grantor, the creator of the original restricted covenant?
Well, let me see if I understand your argument. Factory outlet and or discount retail stores is, it seems to me, what the next sentence is referring to, upon the discontinuance of such use. Your argument is that they get to have whatever use it is at the outset, one or the other, and as soon as one or the other that they've previously chosen is discontinued, it triggers the expiration of the restriction.
Yes, sir. I would state it, if I might, just only slightly differently, that if we look at the phrase for so long as the remaining property of the party of the first part is being used as a factory outlet and or discount retail stores. So we have to say, well, what does and or mean? It means or. And if the court thinks there's any ambiguity about that, we, of course, get the benefit of the construction because of the longstanding rules regarding the interpretation of restrictive covenants. If you then, as a matter of construction, substitute that phrase into that language into the last sentence, upon the discontinuation of the use of the remaining property as a factory outlet or discount retail stores, the expiration shall expire.
What was there in 1989 when the deed recited this restriction?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
Well,
of the
in 1989 is where this language was first drafted and incorporated into a document.
Yes, sir.
In the deed.
Yes, sir.
What was present on the site then?
Well, it's an excellent question. So there, it's an interesting election issue, and I don't know what the correct answer is in terms of this, but this court's prior decision in 1998 that Mr. Tanner referred to, if I look at the first substantive paragraph, it says this, the relevant facts here are not in dispute. Shenandoah Village Associates, predecessor to title to appellant, Waynesboro Village, was the original developer of a retail shopping mall. A retail shopping mall. So if it's appropriate for the court to consider a factual recitation in a prior case, I don't know that it is, but if it is, it was a retail shopping mall. I would also point to the court in in a number of different places in the joint appendix. Joint appendix page 1, the appellant's complaint in paragraph number 3 alleges that the Waynesboro Outlet Village is a shopping center. It actually says, to be technically correct, the Waynesboro Outlet Village shopping center. I would point to the court to joint appendix page 66 is part of the historical rent rolls, and one of the stores that you will see that occupied this property prior to the June 2006 time period was a Bed Bath & Beyond, which is of the same ilk of the store that is there today, like a Target. If that's not a retail store, then I don't know what is.
Well, it says discount retail store and factory outlet. I don't presume to be an expert on these subjects, but my wife is. And she tells me she goes to factory outlets because they are discount retail stores. So, I mean, what's the definition of all this?
Well, and of course, your question begs the issue of if it's unclear at all, if it's ambiguous, if it's subject to more than one reasonable construction, of course, there's an ambiguity, and the well-established rules by this court are that in that event, the language must be construed strongly against the grantor in favor of the...
Well, actually, in this case, it might not be to your advantage, because what they're about to do is certainly one or the other, and they have a 14-month interval, and they're tearing down the one building, and they're moving into what they call discount retail stores. And the restriction talks about such use. So if such use is really broad and expansive, how could it have been discontinued?
Well, there are at least three answers to that question. First off, we're talking about the expiration clause, and the expiration is upon the discontinuance of such use. So I don't want to pick with the court, but I think it really is important that we're talking about not the restriction, but the expiration of the restriction. So that's point number one. Point number two, if the court were to look at Judge Franklin's letter opinion, which is incorporated in the final order in the trial court below, and specifically it's at page 303 of the joint appendix, over and over and over again, Judge Franklin recites the fact that the property had been used as for discount retail purposes, and that's not been challenged on appeal. In fact, if you look at the appellant's first assignment of error, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, but the first assignment of error is the trial court erred because the property had been consistently and continuously used as discount retail stores. So the idea that somehow there had only been one but not the other is not supported in the record and is inconsistent with the record. The third thing I would say is that if you look at the expiration clause itself, And as we read it and as Judge Franklin read it, we have at least 7 specific explicit indicators that this was supposed to be a very narrow restriction, that part of the general intent for the development of these properties was that the restriction could expire as it relates to the 4-acre parcel. And here they are very quickly. This restriction shall only apply, that's the first one, for so long as, there's the second condition, any portion of the remaining property owned by the party of the first part is being used, and that's critical here. It doesn't say that there's an intent to use in the future, that it may be used in the future, that there's a plan to be used, but is being used. That's the present progressive verb tense, and if we go back to the first case that was argued today and this case right now, words have meaning.
So in your estimation, if there had been a fire of undetermined origin at the store and it burned and they had to rebuild, that would trigger this discontinuance?
Yes. It said the original drafter could have said, like the zoning ordinance and the Board of Zoning versus Cajal case, upon a discontinuance that lasts at least a minimum duration. But the original drafter, the original grantor, didn't do that. It's absolutely correct. And the other thing that I would say is the drafter uses the word upon. Upon means immediately. So you could have introduced that. Discontinuance, we've provided a number of plain language definitions of discontinuance. It's a cessation or interruption, whether temporary or permanent. If the grantor had wanted or intended there to be something else required, the grantor could have used another word like abandon or introduced the concept of subjective intent.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
As we all puzzle over the term factory outlet and or discount retail store, I understand Mr. Tanner's argument that you move from factory outlet to discount retail store. I understand your argument. There's actually a third interpretation that's plausible, and that is that you move away from either factory outlet or discount retail store, or both, into some totally different use. Is there anything that would indicate a use permit or any sort of a local government approval that's being sought that's reflected in the record that would show a use other than some sort of retail?
Not that I'm aware of. But if there are three possible interpretations, of course, Chick-fil-A Inc. gets the benefit of the one that's most favorable to the free use of the property. The other thing that I think is
well, suppose that the building was the site of a crime scene, and the local police department put the yellow tape around it for a week. Under your argument, that would be a discontinuance of the use.
It may well be, although that's an awfully extreme example.
Well, it may be, but that's why we use hypotheticals to find out what these words mean.
Yeah. Well, I would conclude by this, that if there's any ambiguity, if there's an alternative reasonable construction this court wants to impose on it, then Chick-fil-A Inc. gets the benefit of the doubt. The other thing is that the grantor used specific words. This court is not, should not introduce words and concepts not there. The other thing is that Waynesboro Village LLC wanted to do something different. It could have done it when it conveyed the property to Waynesboro TC.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Mr. Tanner?
Thank you. Now, I'd like to thank Mr. Barkley for these kind words earlier. That was very unexpected and very pleasant to hear. I think I want to address Justice Mim's question first. Our position all along has been that this restrictive covenant, the general plan of development that this court found in 1998, really governed the use of this property. And until you have a change in use away from the retail, away from either a factory outlet or discount retail, which I'll address the distinction between the two in a moment.
Can I stop you just for a second? My understanding of his position is he doesn't have any problem with the change in use. That's not the problem at all. The problem is the discontinuance. He's saying the fact that you for 14 months weren't doing anything there is the reason why the restrictive covenant is no longer effective. So why are we talking about whether it was a discount store or retail? He said it doesn't matter what it was before, and he doesn't have a problem with that, from my understanding.
I believe you've accurately stated what he's talking about. Our issue is, during the course of the demolition and then reconstruction, what was the property actually being used for? Certainly the intent was to continue the discount retail.
Right.
He's saying it doesn't matter what the intent is.
Right.
The problem that we have with the way that the trial court analyzed this and with this particular argument is that there is no limiting principle. How long does it have to stop? Now, everybody to these transactions went into them with their eyes completely wide open about what this was. It's important to note that Chick-fil-A actually has indemnity on this specific issue from Waynesboro TC. And to get at what you're talking about, when you go in with your eyes wide open and you're aware that this restriction applies to the property that you're purchasing, you understand going in that we have a problem here. The problem ultimately circles back to whether or not you can say that the use discontinued when everything that was being done on the property was being done to facilitate the same use that's covered by the restrictive covenant. Now, I'm aware I've skipped around a little bit. I didn't want to do that. But I have a tendency to do that occasionally when I think about this case. But the point here is, what they're saying is a discontinuance. We're saying simply isn't one. Because the process of reconstructing and renovating a shopping center into a shopping center is using the property as a shopping center. And Mr. Barkley made reference to the Cajal case that we have cited, and I think that's an important reference for the court. Now, while I understand this court didn't specifically address the issue under a vested rights zoning issue, whether the use discontinued after the store had burned down. Clearly, the circuit court found that the reconstruction during the period of time before the notice of the zoning violation in that case that led to the BZA case and then led to the circuit court case, that was, in fact, using the property as a grocery store, and that was a lawful nonconforming use under those circumstances. And that issue wasn't actually appealed and therefore wasn't addressed by this court. But our
Counsel,
position is...
On,
yes, ma'am.
On this is being used, the trial court makes a point about this, but in the deed it says is being used. So how does your view on this constitute is being used?
Well, certainly...
You're saying during the raising of the village and the building of the Target shopping center that it was still being, it is being used for a retail discount store.
Precisely. Yes, it is. It's being used for the purpose of discount retail because you're doing something to facilitate discount retail. And that's the issue here, I think, is best done. I don't like using analogies, but most residential zoning districts do not permit expressly by right construction. But one would be hard-pressed to say you can't build your house because it's not permitted. That means that when you're building building the house, it's being used for residential purposes that are permitted in that district. And I think that's the best analogy that I've been able to come up with in dealing with that, and I think that comes right straight out of the at least logic of the Cajal case. I see my time is more than up.
Gentlemen, the court does appreciate the professional manner in which you've handled this case and the courtesies that you've extended to one another, because it demonstrates beyond question that you can disagree without being disagreeable. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will take a brief recess.